Hi there, my name is Paddy Butler. This podcast is brought to you from Liberia, a bookshop by Second Home. Now, there have been many exceptional books on tech and the broader implications of the internet's effect on society. Some of the titles to top that list for me include Shoshana Zuboff's The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, Marcus du Sautoy's excellent The Creativity Code, which is essentially as close as you can get to defining human creativity within 300 odd pages. Astonishing work for that in itself. Really love that. And we also had Marcus speak here at Second Home, and we recorded a little podcast with him as well, so you can check that out. And then there's Radical Technologies by Adam Greenfield, which is interesting in the sense that he draws very little distinction between big tech's colonization of our everyday and traditional state colonial expansion. But I have a particular fondness for James Bridle's New Dark Age. Given he's such a brilliant writer, adds to it, but I've known James and his conceptual artwork, and I think this allows him a truly varied and unique perspective. I luckily caught up with James, and we discussed some of the many exciting and scary ideas within his masterful book. You are going through history as well. You are looking at modernity in essence, and I suppose the scientific revolution as well, and how that is, I suppose, in essence, concrete to how the internet has evolved. Obviously, there's the technology in essence behind that, but there's a hard edge of criticism towards the pursuit of scientific perfection.
Yeah, I mean, this was a real problem or fear that I faced in writing it, because the more questions I asked, the more I was questioning.
Yeah.
Quite, and I try and contain it in the book to really kind of post 1940s computational modernity.
Yeah.
But of course, it goes back further, because it was implementing ideas that are absolutely at the basis, not just the scientific revolution, but really of the Enlightenment itself.
Mm.
And that's kind of what I realized I was starting to question in the book. But this plays back into questions of complexity. Like, what does it mean to question the Enlightenment as something that we live by so completely unthinkingly?
Yeah.
And what does it mean to question things like that? To say, are we saying that they are wrong? Mm. Are we simply saying that their time has passed and there's time to think anew and to think of different ways of thinking? And how do you think around these subjects rather than just simply trying to sort of demolish them and replace them with something else?
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Yeah. Yeah, and how do you think we go about doing that? I mean, because going in, all right.
These are the big questions.
No, okay. Well, let's play fair. Let's go back into that complexity. You talk about a cage of complexity, and maybe
I'm not sure about a cage actually.
Okay,
I see that as. So a way to start to think about that complexity is I frame it in the book is when I talk about the figure of the cloud.
Yes.
Which is a kind of a favorite thing of mine to kind of keep coming back to and going over and over and over, because I and a lot of other artists, and this happened a lot in the visual arts world, I think more than in the writing, but I do some of it in the book. Do this big thing about when we talk about the cloud, the computational cloud, the branded cloud, we make this big point of talking about how we're really talking about like data centers and physical computers and huge mines extracting materials for smartphones and this kind of doing this kind of material analysis on the digital world in order to situate it geographically and politically.
Yes.
And this is a really kind of powerful, useful work to do because it allows you to bring a bunch of sort of different and materialist forms of critique to questions of technology. So it's a really, really useful exercise. And I love doing it, and it's really fascinating. You go out and you point at bits of the internet and understand certain things about the way the world works.
Mm.
But at the same time, what I do in the book is then I kind of turn that metaphor over once again to say that while the cloud is a metaphor that kind of obscures power in these ways that are quite dangerous, it's also crazily accurate because the world is cloudy and unknowable in this certain ways. And so when I talk about complexity, I'm talking about this idea of things that are complexity means multi-dimensional in ways that the brain can't accommodate, either because it's too large a scale, because it's too deep, too wide, whatever it is. Yeah. Complexity simply means it's something that we cannot grasp and master meaningfully. But it doesn't mean we can't live with it and within it kind of safely. Mm. And it's that skill that I'm trying to kind of work towards throughout the book.
So, just to quote on that from the book, admitting to the indescribable is one facet of the new dark age, an admission that the human mind has limits to what it can conceptualize. So that's kind of framing that. Also, to tie into that, you've done a recent program on Radio 4, and you term, you've come up with this idea of the new aesthetic. And I guess that's about, visibility as well, isn't it? Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the new aesthetic is kind of years old now. It was and remains a kind of weird project. Mm. That came out of something quite specific. But has informed all my work since, which was that, we're looking kind of 8-9 years ago now. Mm. But it had been building for a while. I was working in tech primarily at the time. I was building websites. I was looking at all this kind of weirdness. Mm. And getting the first intimations of what I go really deep into in book of this gap between the visible appearance of the world and like what's really going on because of technology. The way that super manifested at the time was I was essentially looking at things like, I was thinking about things like essentially the triumph of retro in culture, of vintage, of the weirdness of everyone going around with supercomputers in their pockets but dressing like blacksmiths.
Interesting.
And going coffee shops filled with chalkboards and pieces of wood and this absolute fetishization of what was perceived to be authentic, even though it was all completely fake. And this weird obsession with, as I say, kind of craft and retro at the moment of something cutting edge. Mm-hmm. And it felt like it was because we had no way to conceptualize and understand what this thing was, and its very quality was its invisibleness. Mm. Technology was disappearing even as it became more powerful. And so the new aesthetic was an attempt to find things that looked like the future, or frankly the present, that actually genuinely represented it. And that was, as the title suggests, largely an aesthetic project, just to find stuff that looked crazy. But as soon as you started to see it, it gave you purchase, and you could start to kind of pull yourself over the edge and start to see something like the cloud, as we were just discussing about, that you actually had some kind of intellectual access to this sphere once you started to put a surface on top of it. And ways of seeing, new ways of seeing on the program which you did on Radio 4 does that to some extent. It was a number of examples of like, here's a thing you can look at. Mm. Now here's someone who's, particularly with artists, who's exploring under the surface of that.
Okay, interesting. And in relation to that as well, just in terms of, I suppose, your own take on psychogeography and the city, where you walked from one end of, I think you traveled, or did you walk or did you cycle from one end of London to the other?
I did. So that was part of a project I actually did for the Hayward Gallery a few years ago, for their Mirror City exhibition. Mm. And I did three journeys through various types of infrastructure. So the first one was a walk around the congestion charge zone, where I photographed every single camera that could see me. Which is a combination of like the number plate cameras and the private cameras, council cameras, TfL cameras, the whole works.
Right.
Several thousand cameras over the course of a day's walk, basically. It's very intense and very kind of paranoia-inducing experience.
I'm not sure I'd want to do that myself.
I think it was part of sort of, not why I moved out of London, but like when I was not in London, I feel a little straightening of my shoulders. So there was this walk around the congestion zone in which I was arrested for photographing cameras, because that's what happens if you do that
at data centers specifically. Or
no, that was on Park Lane.
Right.
But I was also harassed by security guards at the data centers when I did a cycle ride from Slough out to Basildon. Mm-hmm. So from sort of 50 clicks west to 50 clicks east of London, along this line of microwave towers that connects the data centers of the London and New York stock exchanges.
Okay. Can we go into that actually?
Yeah.
Let's talk about it, because that's fascinating as well. The data centers and also this colonization process. Mm. It's almost like the imperial okay, I mean, we're talking big, but like...
No, it's exactly that. And like that's precisely what I found on the journey. So when I first start talking about the kind of imperial level of these technologies, I think in the book and you know, usually elsewhere, is talk about submarine cables. So if you can, you know, it's one of these points at which you're like, oh, that's what the internet actually looks like and this is how it functions, is when you look at a map of submarine cables. Because the internet travels around the world through, in many places, through very narrow channels. There's more and more of these cables, but like they follow quite set paths, and you can go to submarinecablemap.com and you can see this amazing map of really the map of the internet.
Yeah.
And one thing that's fairly immediately obvious is it follows very historical clear routes, because largely these connections were formed along the same lines that telegraph routes
had done before.
The telegraph,
absolutely, yeah.
And the telegraph was obviously laid down by empires.
Yeah.
So, you know, West Africa connects back to London or to the UK before it connects to anywhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. Most of the South America is connected via Spain. Africa only got its first direct cable to the US this year.
Wow.
Right, having previously been entirely tied to the US through Europe, which is a direct colonial legacy. So that form of imperialism really has obviously never gone away, but it's startlingly clear to what extent it moved up into the framework of infrastructure almost immediately. Mm. And the you know, and you can go outside and you can see versions of this happening. So when I was interested in these two data centers. Mm. So it's in Slough, there's the data center for the London Stock Exchange, and in Basildon, east of London, there's the New York Stock Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And because these stock exchanges are largely machine run, so most of the trades that are happening on them are automatic, i.e. they're programs that are running faster than the human brain can work to make tiny millions and millions of little trades, earning a few cents and making billions of millions.
Flash trading.
Flash trading, high-frequency trading, the Flash Boys and Michael Lewis book, which is very good on this. That's how the stock exchanges work. It's basically a series of like warring algorithms written by physics PhDs operating at close to the speed of light and exploiting the kind of qualities of electrons itself to make money. And so to better exploit that, to run ever faster, they need to build faster and faster connections between these places, which is first of all involves making the shortest route you can through fiber optic cables. And then if you want to beat even that, light travels faster through air than it does through glass. Mm-hmm. So the fastest way without, you know, breaking too many laws of physics is through microwave beams, point to point. But for that, you need a line of sight. So they're quite short hops, or you need them very high up. And they're visible. You can go out and you can see these things. And so you can go along the street, or you can go find these places. You can look up, you can see where that dish is pointed, and you can follow it, you know, by line and on foot or on bicycle to the next one. And when I did that, you know, I found these spots along the route, particularly kind of west of London. And the moment that I write about in the book that was the sort of most...
ironic.
The moment when this sort of becomes so incredibly clear is the moment outside Hillingdon Hospital, just north of Heathrow, which is one of these huge 1960s kind of NHS slab concrete public health buildings. You know, absolutely the embodiment of Bevan's kind of belief that... you know, we can build things for the good of all of us. And on top of this, I'll perch these two microwave dishes through which billions and billions and billions of private transactions are flowing. Mm-hmm. These things are literally kind of perched there like parasites. And while I couldn't quite get I couldn't get the hospital to tell me how much they were paid in rent, I did manage to get a Freedom of Information request that put it in the low tens of thousands per year compared to the amount of money that's actually flowing through there.
And also, these are set up by companies which are not actually they're cover.
No, I mean the working out who even owns those dishes is offshore shell after offshore shell, kind of deep.
Yeah.
Because the technology mirrors the forms of commerce that it's built to aid of, and the commerce takes advantage of those forms of technology in order to hide itself further away. And yeah. That's the kind of cycle of secrecy that pervades.
Give us figures. Like, you know, we're talking about hundreds of millions of pounds per second, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's just flowing as numbers through the sky.
It's astonishing. And
that's how these things work.
Data centers, it's interesting in your book as well, the data centers themselves, you know, this is, as you say, is AI, and this is where it's kind of critical when things go bad, because a lot of you get the system which is not able to respond to certain information in a human way, and you get a breakdown in terms of like how the technology feeds into the trading system itself. Does that make sense?
I mean, yeah, we don't know to what extent anything in this stuff is intelligent. But the mirroring thing that happens there is that even if these programs aren't that smart, they are operating at such speeds and under conditions of such secrecy that when you get things like flash crashes on the stock exchanges, which have happened several times, and are clearly driven in large part by these automated trading systems, like billions of pounds suddenly evaporate off the stock market and then bounce back in seconds, and we basically have no idea what happened. And whether that's being done by intelligent systems or fairly dumb, just very quick software agents doesn't really matter. I mean, the point is that we're talking about kind of vast, huge systems that are critical to our life support. We don't really understand what's happening inside them. And more of life, essentially, is turning into that. The moment I really take as emblematic is the game between Lisa Doll and AlphaGo, the famous Go game a couple of years ago, because it was billed as kind of, you know, Kasparov versus Deep Blue Mark II, you know, and the Kasparov Deep Blue game was amazing, and is a fascinating moment in our like ideas about computation, what it's capable of, but it's fundamentally different because we understand how Deep Blue made the decisions that it made. This is the difference between those two games. Deep Blue was a very powerful computer with a, you know, just a deep search strategy that essentially outprocessed the human brain. But it did it, it was brute force. It just did it by calculating as many possible options as before. Like, AlphaGo is a fundamentally different creation in that it has learned and it makes decisions. And the way in which it makes those decisions are not explicable to humans.
Yeah.
So we will never know how it decided to make the moves that it did. And they're amazing, extraordinary moves, but it's playing in another world now. And so, you know, what happens when technologies like that, that are generally incomprehensible to humans, are in everything around us. We start to live in this sort of haunted world.
And I
have to always be careful bringing in these kind of like weird, magical, whatever metaphors.
Sure.
But at the same time, that's very definitely how it appears to us. And no longer just because we don't know how it works, but because we cannot.
Amazing. And that goes hand in hand as well with technology. It's technology is created to feed an economy as opposed to help an economy. Isn't that kind of where we're... Is that maybe where we're at?
It's certainly what it's, you know, mostly being used for at present.
Yeah. In terms of, you know, also related to what you talk about, peak knowledge as well, I suppose, in a sense.
The peak knowledge thing is largely sort of around, is around kind of prediction, essentially. It's like, there's an interesting distinction to be made there when we're talking about information and knowledge and data and all these kind of things. Which I've sort of realized in you saying that. So when we talk about all of this information being available, the belief is that it is the world that we've accessed, right, through having that information. And what we realize is that it's not information about the world. It's information about our understanding or our modeling ability of the world that we then use for things.
Yes.
And the belief is that if we gather enough information, like our use of the world will improve.
Yeah.
Or our ability to predict it, for example. Mm. So when we say that peak knowledge is past, it means that the information that we have about the world is less and less useful to us. A particular example of that in the book being weather forecasting, which I use in the book as a kind of model for how we access, process, and build models of the world, and then predict it. And the fact that because of climate change, quite directly, our ability to predict is failing because our data about the world is no longer any good because the world has fundamentally changed. which you know ends that entire kind of possibility of future prediction.
Interesting, fascinating. And also in relation to, I mean, there's so much in the book. I guess there's a certain parallel there with, you quote Arundhati Roy and the end of imagination. There is that, like, you know, with nuclear arms, you know?
Yeah, so, I mean, I talk a bit about this idea, the business idea of data being the new oil, and how just hideous that is on every level, because oil is bad. So why would we? But also what it tells us about this kind of thinking and a number of other things. I would say it's more like atomic energy, and that it's, you know, it's like astonishingly dangerous but powerful in all of these kind of interesting ways. And I think the imagination point is interesting. So Arundhati Roy wrote this amazing little book called The End of Imagination, as you say, about India's first nuclear bomb, and why it represents this kind of end point in humanity's possible thinking about the world. And I think that question of imagining something else runs throughout this. I've been thinking about it particularly in the context of artificial intelligence recently, and why it's necessary to reimagine this stuff differently. Because I've kind of come to a certain realization about AI, which everyone's been talking about a lot lately. I'm particularly interested. Well, so there's one thing that happens is that when I get asked about AI, I always jokingly say, like, oh, it's, you know, we already have AI; it already exists. It's corporations. Corporations are large, automated, goal-directed organizations with a bunch of, with very clear kind of motivations, reward systems, and all these kinds of things.
Yes,
they self-optimize.
Yeah.
They have sensors and effectors, which are basically people, but they use them to move towards their very direct goals, and they have pain points, and they're trained to behave in certain ways. They have a kind of mean lifespan of maybe 30 to 40 years, you know, but they exist, and they're real. And that's also leads you on to a second realization, which is why there's an interesting subset of the crazy billionaires club, like Elon Musk and others, who are like really, really afraid of AI in certain ways, because they recognize it's the one thing that might take their power from them.
Yes.
Essentially, it might treat them like they've treated the rest of us. But then bringing those two realizations together is that this imagination that. They like AI could only be like a corporation, right? They can't imagine an intelligence that operates according to another logic.
Yes,
and it doesn't have to operate to that logic. That does not have to be the logic of intelligence. It's not the logic of most human intelligence, but unfortunately, it is the logic of most of the people who are building AI. So this
Google Translate, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, Google Translate is such an uninteresting. Interesting AI, but when you start putting it into other countries, but you know, throughout history, there's a fairly recent history. There's other ways that we could imagine these technologies outside these particular corporate bounds. Okay. Whether that's kind of in advanced AI stuff, or whether it's in just simple little smaller distributed systems, and the way we build the internet today, like those possibilities exist. And so,
it's about shifting that.
Yeah, it's about actually working on those
and you,
things.
And you waking up almost.
Yeah. No, I mean the book is called New Dark Age because for these various things we've discussed, this kind of uncertainty about the value of enlightenment as a thing.
Yeah.
This argument against data and kind of information being the thing that we need more of.
The pursuit,
but the darkness is also not necessarily a bad place to be. It allows us to think differently and talk to one another in different ways.
Final thing in the book, which I thought was a beautiful passage, you go back to Prometheus and Epimetheus, and that's kind of key, isn't it? In the sense of like, it's heartening as well. At the same time, in the sense of like, the humanities are so important. I interviewed Roberto Colasso. A few weeks ago, and you know, reading his book, the Marriage of Cadmus and Harmony, you are rereading it. You really get that sense of the classics can still teach so much.
Yeah, I mean, they're real stories. Like, yeah. they're addressing exactly the same issues.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely nothing has changed in humanity's desire to use tools, essentially whatever those tools may be. In the case of myth, it's fire. But that's as relevant as technology as anything we're building today. And those stories recognize the same tendencies within humanity.
The same use those, conflicts as
the
well.
The same conflicts, yeah. Yeah. This would produce conflict and therefore it would produce the opportunity for tyranny and oppression.
Yeah.
And therefore you need a counterbalance to that.
Yeah.
You have both a reason that occurs in kind of Epimetheus's forgetfulness and uncertainty. You have this double balancing act of then putting Prometheus in and giving us these tools to counter this like lack within humanity,
yes.
our need to struggle and need to survive. But because they're gods, they're bastards, and they kind of overrule that way as well. And then the tools themselves are so powerful, and so they sent down Hermes to attempt to mediate. And actually, the key figure in that story is neither Prometheus or Epimetheus, both of whom are idiots in their own way.
Yeah.
But Hermes is like acknowledges the idiocy and is basically like, everyone be nice and talk to one another.
Yeah.
It's not a complicated myth, particularly. Yeah. But all parts of it are there and are present. And are meaningful. I think that's the lovely thing about reading those stories is like you really get to them having a very clear and certain meaning,
an essence almost.
An essence, but I would say that in the book I'm also trying to say that like technology has this meaning as well. More broadly, like technology is a story that we're continually telling ourselves through the things that we invent.
Yeah.
And the argument I make in the book is also you can listen to the results of computation in the same way that you listen to the moral of a myth.
Yeah.
Because these are both things that are being played out in terms of human experience that have lessons to be learned from. They're not random experiments. They're not weird little odd stories. Both myth and the results of our own technologies are actionable, comprehensible, meaningful events in the world that we're part of.
Brilliant. James Bridle, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Well, there you go. Brilliant stuff from my guest, James Bridle. Again, do check out his book, New Dark Age. Really is a brilliant read and jam-packed with interesting ideas as discussed on the Liberia podcast just now. As always, for full cultural program listings, do check out the website secondhome.io. See you next time.